Hello and welcome to the Promise Institute podcast. I'm Natalie Monsanto, the Institute's Communications and Development Manager. And of course, the Promise Institute is the home for human rights here at the UCLA School of Law. In this episode, you'll hear our Assistant Director, Jess Peek, discussing the recent Facebook Oversight Board's decision regarding former President Trump's access to the platform. She spoke with Michael Karanikolas, the Executive Director of the brand new Institute for Technology, Law, and Policy at, you guessed it, the UCLA School of Law. The Oversight Board's decision regarding former President Trump upheld Facebook's initial ban of Trump from the platform. However, they also called into question Facebook's decision-making process and its decision to permanently ban anyone. Their findings concluded the ban itself was appropriate given the content of Trump's posts, but the indefinite length of the ban was inappropriate because the process for making this decision was so murky. And because prior to this, Facebook had never said a permanent ban was an option, making this remedy for this violation something which seemed to break what precedent was known to exist at the company. Ultimately, they told Facebook to come back within 6 months with a better process and more clarity on what to do moving forward. Since Facebook is a global social media platform, the Oversight Board has relied on recognized norms of international human rights law in its decision-making. You'll hear Jess and Michael explore the relationship between the board and Facebook, why Facebook is not the same as government when it comes to questions of freedom of expression, and ways in which the board suggests Facebook's processes do not meet with international human rights law standards.
Welcome, Michael.
Thank you so much for having me.
Michael, before we get started on our discussion, do you want to tell us a little bit about the new institute and the work that you'll be doing at UCLA?
Yeah, I would love to. The UCLA Institute for Technology, Law, and Policy is a new research center that is set up as an interdisciplinary institute between the law faculty and the engineering faculty. And the purpose of it is to develop research and policy around pressing issues at the intersection of law and tech. So it's obviously an incredibly exciting space. A particular value of the institute is the fact that it is an interdisciplinary structure. You know, a lot of conversations in the law and tech space tend to be very siloed. So we're really hoping to break that down and to create a dialogue that can inform policy discussions with reference to both insight from folks on the tech side and from traditional voices in the law and policy space.
That's great. We're really excited to have you on board. And I should also mention that together we're planning a summer speaker series on digital rights starting on June 17th. And so our listeners should stay tuned to the Promise social media for more information about those upcoming events.
Absolutely. It's open to the public, and we would love to have as many participants as possible who are interested in learning more about emerging digital rights challenges.
So we're here today to discuss the recent Facebook Oversight Board decision regarding the ban of then-President Donald J. Trump from the Facebook and Instagram platforms on January 7th of 2021. As I'm sure our listeners remember, this ban resulted from Trump making repeated unfounded claims about the election between him and now President Joe Biden being stolen from Donald Trump, and in particular for several posts on January 6th. On that date, at President Trump's urging, there was a rally in Washington, D.C., where people turned out to stop the steal, a movement that sprang up very quickly after Trump began making claims of a stolen election in November. On the morning of January 6th, Trump attended a rally near the White House and gave a speech where he continued to make unfounded claims that he had won the election and suggested that Vice President Mike Pence should overturn President-elect Joe Biden's victory, and Congress was set to vote to certify the election that day. Many of those who attended the rally then marched to the U.S. Capitol building. During the rally, Trump urged people to go to the Capitol, and upon arriving, many protesters violently attacked the Capitol, entering the building and rioting. Five people died and many more people were injured. In a video posted at 4:21 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, while the incursion on the Capitol building was ongoing, Trump posted a video and a statement to his Facebook page and to Instagram, where he continued to claim that the election was stolen and stripped away, and praised and supported those who were rioting at the Capitol, saying, "We love you, you're very special." He also called on them to remain peaceful. This post was removed by Facebook at 5:41 p.m. for violating its community standard on dangerous individuals and organizations. At 6:07 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Trump posted a second statement, a written statement, saying that these are the things and events that happen when a sacred landslide election victory is so unceremoniously, viciously stripped away from great patriots who've been very badly, unfairly treated for so long. Go home with love in peace. Remember this day forever. Facebook removed this post at 6:15 p.m., again for violating its community standard on dangerous individuals and organizations, and at that point imposed a 24-hour block on Trump's accounts on the two platforms. The next day, on January 7th, Facebook extended the block indefinitely and for at least the next 2 weeks until the peaceful transition of power is complete. Facebook cited Mr. Trump's use of the platform to incite violent insurrection against a democratically elected government. On January 21st, Facebook announced it had referred this case to the Oversight Board and had asked the Oversight Board to decide whether the decision to prohibit Trump for an indefinite period of time was correct. That decision was delivered on May 5th, and that is the decision that we are here to discuss today. So, Michael, before we get into the specifics of that decision, can you give us some background on the Oversight Board more generally? When was it set up? Is it independent? How was it created?
So the Facebook Oversight Board has been around for less than a year right now, and it was constituted by Facebook as a sort of quasi-independent structure to oversee their decision-making and to provide policy advice and recommendations on the many, many, many issues of political and social controversy that Facebook has found itself embroiled in. The board was, in terms of the motivation for setting up the board, you could point to a few different factors. Facebook obviously finds itself increasingly in the midst of political controversies where not only is there no easy answer, but there's no outcome that they can select that will not result in them being criticized and the target for anger by a large number of people. And the Trump decision is a good example of that, where either way that this went, there's going to be a lot of people, including very powerful people, who are very angry at Facebook. So the Oversight Board, as an external structure, as a quasi-independent structure, it provides sort of not only an independent voice by people that have expertise on freedom of expression, human rights, journalism, what have you. But it also provides a neat avenue for Facebook to deflect criticism so that they can hand over challenging policy decisions to this external structure. Now, in terms of the independence of the board, obviously it was established by Facebook. Facebook did not themselves select all of the members of the board. There was a process by which Facebook selected the individual, the initial members, and then those initial members selected additional people to join up. There's an independent administrative structure associated with it. The funding was originally provided by Facebook, though I believe it was provided through an irrevocable trust, which is actually quite good practice as far as guaranteeing the independence of these kinds of institutions, insofar as it ensures that you're not in a position where Facebook can suddenly pull the rug out from under you if you come back with a decision that they don't like. And if you look at the composition of the board themselves, I believe, has been nothing but support and praise of the actual candidates for the board. Now, there have been criticisms that Western North American perspectives are overly represented on the board, that there are regions of the world that are either not represented or underrepresented in terms of the board's first cohort. But there's a lot of very highly respected, brilliant minds that are on there. So typically the individual voices themselves are generally people who are widely respected, at least among the sort of the freedom of expression community, if you want to think about it that way. So all of that is to say, it is a quasi-independent structure staffed by some very smart people. However, it is worth noting that the board's actual remit to implement change at Facebook is very limited. While they can examine these questions, they can deliver policy advice, their actual freedom to force Facebook to incorporate that advice into their policies is quite another matter and is very limited at the moment.
Although the decisions are supposed to be binding on Facebook, right? So Facebook are supposed to have some duty to implement the decisions that come from the board.
So the board will hear an appeal on an individual moderation decision, like should this specific post or should this piece of content go down or stay up? When the board makes a determination, Facebook is bound to apply their decision to that specific piece of content. But of course, you know, in the vast universe of content moderation decisions that are out there, one little piece of content is usually not that impactful, with the decision of whether or not or how to treat Donald Trump's account maybe being the exception to that, because that is obviously one very significant decision. But for the most part, you know, what's far more important than the decision over the specific piece of content, which is binding, is the degree to which the broader policy or rule is impacted the next time Facebook sees an identical or very similar piece of content. And in that sense, the board's powers are much more limited.
Got it. And so you mentioned that the board is very new, but it has issued some decisions already. I believe there have been 9 decisions so far. So from what we've seen, what do we know about how the board is approaching its work?
So one of the first things to note, and I think this is a useful counterargument to the folks that have dismissed the board as just a puppet of Facebook, is that the board has not been shy thus far. First of all, at overturning Facebook's original decisions, which the board has had no compunction over pushing back and telling Facebook that it was wrong. And more than that, the board has taken a reasonably aggressive and expansive understanding of its mandate in terms of the policy recommendations that it has made. So to give you an example, there was a recent case coming out of India, and the board noted that Facebook never bothered to translate their community standards into Punjabi, which is an enormous language. Millions of people that speak Punjabi. It's not a small language group. And this challenge of the fact that Facebook hasn't translated their community standards into the many different languages that their users speak and that they operate in is a very common and longstanding complaint. I personally have been making this complaint to Facebook since at least 2015. So the fact that it is still a problem is kind of galling, and it's good that but this is one of these issues that was tangential to the core of what the board was actually asked. They're examining a particular piece of content, and they're noting ancillary problems in the way that Facebook is organizing their business. Now, I will also add, as far as criticisms of the board go, there is another criticism that essentially says that the focus on content, that the limited remit of what the board can and can't do, is a distraction from the broader problem of Facebook, which revolves around their business model, their data policies. That's a different story. If your position is that an oversight board focusing on content is insufficient to resolve the challenges and the problem of the company itself, then I think that that's an argument that's worth having. But I think that on the question of the degree to which the oversight board has taken an independent approach to its admittedly limited remit, I think that there is a lot to be said for the way that they've assessed problems and for their willingness to engage on areas where Facebook has fallen short.
Okay, so now let's get into the Trump decision specifically. So we understand that the board was asked to review Facebook's decision to ban Trump from Facebook and Instagram platforms following January 6th. What were the specific questions that the board was asked to answer?
So Facebook asked the board 2 questions. First was, considering their Facebook values and their commitments to voice and safety, did Facebook correctly decide to prohibit Donald Trump's access to posting content on Facebook and Instagram for an indefinite amount of time? And the second question was a broader call for observations or recommendations from the board about suspensions when the user is a political leader. The board's response to this was kind of interesting. So first of all, they essentially upheld Facebook's determination that Donald Trump's having access to the account and his messaging was dangerous, that it was the right thing to do. They agreed with the ultimate finding that he should have his account suspended. However, they took issue with the lack of process on Facebook's side in arriving at that determination. And that, you know, is so telling insofar as, you know, one of the major challenges and one of the constant criticisms of Facebook is that it's very difficult to tease out the process and decision-making, the process that underlines the company's decision-making. In a lot of ways, you know, that could be one of the reasons why the Oversight Board was constituted, is to develop that process and to support actual reasoned thinking to underlie the decision-making, to bring the company out of this Mark decides paradigm where, you know, ultimately you can have these standards and these values and these guidelines, but it's really just up to this one guy at the top to determine the ultimate decision. And it's ironic that given this effort to build in more process, clearly decisions are still apparently being made on an ad hoc basis. The board found that in addition to the problematic process, the idea of an indefinite suspension is itself kind of problematic insofar as it lacks the standard of clarity that we look for in international human rights law in assessing the validity of decisions. Clarity is one of the most important things in rulemaking according to international human rights law, and that Facebook failed to live up to that standard as understood in the company's context. So they essentially said to the company, you need to redo your analysis and come back to us within 6 months and with a proper analysis about whether or not and to what degree Donald Trump's access to the account poses a continuing danger or a continuing problem, and to carry out a proper analysis. It's a very interesting answer on that side insofar as it's reminiscent almost of the kind of judicial dialogue that you often see or that I'm familiar with in the context of Canada's Supreme Court, where rather than necessarily recrafting a particular law or policy, the Supreme Court will take a very limited or restrained view of their mandate and powers and sort of nudge the government and say, well, you did this wrong, go back and do it properly so that you learn your lesson, as opposed to just saying, here's the way that you're meant to do this. The reason why I think the board is facing some criticism in this context is, unlike the case with Supreme Courts, where you can make a significant argument for the necessity of judicial restraint in order to uphold the integrity and the role of the legislative rulemaking process, and to understand that courts have a more limited role in guiding the interpretation of laws, the Facebook Oversight Board had previously taken a fairly expansive view of their mandate. And you have a case here where Facebook was really specifically saying to them, do this for us, make a decision for us, please do this work. So that kind of restraint in the decision-making process is kind of interesting from that perspective as compared to the way that this has evolved in different judicial structures. And that said, I think I can understand where the Oversight Board was coming from in arriving at this decision. And I think that there was certain frustration at their side that Facebook still appeared to be performing in a relatively ad hoc basis. But it still is an interesting dynamic to observe. In terms of the observations or recommendations about suspensions when the user is a political leader, the board came back and said that it wasn't really useful to make that kind of a distinction insofar as the assessment should be about the harm and impact from voice, and that while political leaders potentially had greater reach, greater impact, greater influence, and therefore there was a greater capacity for harm and a need to apply rules more carefully, the same is also true of non-political leaders who can be very influential. And Donald Trump, obviously, he's no longer a politician, strictly speaking. He doesn't hold any elected office at the moment. But obviously, he's a person whose voice has the potential for an enormous reach and can be enormously influential. So that's potentially a good example of that. So I think that they seem to be suggesting that the differentiation between whether someone is or is not a political leader isn't that useful. But they seem to reinforce the need to assess in line with international human rights science, specifically around the Rabat plan of action, which they referred to it in a number of places. So that I thought was interesting. I thought they're leaning on international human rights law and their continued use of international human rights law in arriving at these decisions was an interesting thing to watch. It's not surprising because that's been something that's inherent in the Oversight Board's decision-making throughout, but it is nonetheless interesting to see and interesting to watch how that developed.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit more about that and the standards of review that the board were using, drawing specifically on international human rights law. What did that look like?
Yeah, the idea of applying human rights law to the platform's context, to the platform's operations in this context, is incredibly interesting insofar as human rights law is obviously designed primarily with the understanding of being applied to state decisions around speech. That's not to say that companies can't violate international human rights law. There is a long history of understanding going back to the Holocaust that companies can play a part in human rights abuses, human rights violations, continuing to this day with, you know, companies being complicit in murdering environmental activists or in breaking up unions. That's all very well recognized. But on the freedom of expression side, this is all relatively novel. I wrote a paper that was published, I think, last year, specifically called Squaring the Circle Between Platform Law and International Human Rights Law, which is specifically designed to try to bridge over those gaps or to support the development of a framework for applying international human rights law in this kind of context. But it is, in some ways, a challenging fit. In others, it's a very natural extension because the point of international human rights law is to assess the potential harms that flow from speech and where you should draw the line between what is acceptable to say and what is not acceptable to say, where a response is warranted. And from that perspective, it's a natural thing to respond to. There hasn't been, as far as I can see, a huge amount of work to sort of adapt over the gaps between the platform's context of operations and the government's context of operations, except insofar as the board uses international human rights law as a body to inform their understanding of harmful speech and where responses should or should not be warranted and where the line should be drawn between acceptable and unacceptable speech.
We talked earlier about this being a process decision and the board being dissatisfied with the process for review that Facebook carries out. And the board seemed to draw upon some particular human rights standards that should be integrated into that process. Could you talk a little bit about what that could look like?
Yeah. So in line with well-recognized principles of international human rights law, a lot of the analysis of the decision revolves around the three-part test for legitimate restrictions on freedom of expression, namely that those restrictions should be provided by law, imposed for a legitimate purpose, and necessary and proportionate to achieve that purpose. The question of decisions being provided by law is the easiest one to address, and that translates, I think, very, very well from a governmental context to a platform law context, insofar as it mandates that there be clarity in the restrictions, both in terms of how they're structured in the law and how they're applied in practice. And it requires a degree of predictability. And that, I think, cuts to the core of the lack of process that the board has seen. Why that's problematic is if you're developing a new ad hoc response every time you see a challenge, it's not a predictable system in it, and it's not a system which aligns with these international human rights values. On the necessary and proportionate side, I think it's much more challenging because this question of necessity and proportionality revolves around a fundamental idea in international human rights law that restrictions on speech should generally take a light touch and that you should not intervene more heavily in the expressive space than is necessary. So, as a general rule in international human rights law, if a less intrusive or a less heavy-handed response will achieve the same aim, you should tend towards a less heavy-handed response whenever possible. Now, the problem with applying that to a company like Facebook, and again, this is something that I explore in my paper, that when Facebook decides to host Mr. Trump's account, that is not a non-intervention, right? Facebook declining to delete Mr. Trump's account is essentially a decision by the company to provide him with access with a gigantic megaphone to access millions and millions of followers, to harvest their data for his advertising purposes, and to facilitate his political ambitions, right? That is a completely different situation than when a nation state decides not to lock somebody up. Facebook is actively supporting him in his messaging. And so this is why, for me at least, the traditional necessity and proportionality standard is a bit problematic in its application to a platform law context. This was what my paper was about. But you know, those are the standards that you have. And I think that those are still the standards that are informing the discussion. Now, where the board goes with this is they say that indefinite suspensions are generally not a proportional response under international human rights law. You can't just say, you know, if we were going to prohibit a person from accessing the internet or from holding a broadcasting license, the indefinite aspect of that is going to be problematic insofar as it strongly is suggestive of a disproportionate response. And while I'm sympathetic to claims that an indefinite suspension lacks clarity and lacks a proper grounding in Facebook's rules, considering that from a proportionality perspective is a bit more problematic, because to me, the question is, should Facebook be facilitating Mr. Trump's candidacy and his future political ambitions, or should they not? Not should they be taking a decision that silences him unduly? I think that it's a slightly different framing of the question, but I think it's an important difference that reflects the fact that for Facebook to give Mr. Trump his account is not the lack of a decision. It's not the lack of an intervention. It is itself an intervention in a way that non-action by a state actor is not.
So the minority of the board in the decision seem to be saying that the board should be taking into consideration posts that Trump had made prior to the November election, which obviously didn't touch on this specific issue of the election being stolen, but were in other ways inflammatory. And they seem to be saying that that context should be taken into consideration when thinking about this ban as a result of the posts on January 7th. So how have Facebook sort of walked this very fine line, particularly with President Trump, in deciding what to remove from the platform and what not to, right? Because he's obviously made many, many, many false or misleading statements over the period of his presidency.
Yeah, this decision, not only by Facebook, but also by Twitter and by YouTube, is the culmination of years and years and years of people calling for his account to be suspended or removed or pointing to different instances. And I think there's a general consensus by people watching this space that if anybody else was posting the things that he was posting, they would have lost their account ages ago. It's a little bit curious. And again, it's not really evident from the decision exactly how this calculus was arrived at, either because the board didn't want to flesh it out or because the board didn't have that information. But Facebook seems to insist that the idea of newsworthiness didn't come into play in assessing whether or not he should have lost his account or been subject to earlier moderation actions. That's a little bit difficult to understand because so many of his posts were flagged earlier on. So it's difficult to understand the calculus as to why a moderation decision didn't flow from that. But it's tough to tease out the calculus on this. And it's one of the mysteries kind of inherent in this and that's not answered. And it points to a continuing lack of transparency and a lack of understandability about how these things work.
And could you just clarify what you mean by newsworthiness, please, Michael?
So Facebook has an out for its content moderation decision-making, where if a post is found to violate particular community standards, they may decide to keep it up regardless on account of it being newsworthy. So you can think of an example of a particular public figure saying something that is hate speech, but Facebook wants people to see that so that they'll know that that public figure said that thing, and it's important for the electorate to see that in order to inform their decision making. The interesting thing is that in this case, Facebook seemed to indicate that although Mr. Trump's previous posts were very frequently flagged, there was no strikes or adverse action taken against them. And they denied that newsworthiness was a factor in that calculus, which it's, of course, leads to all kinds of questions where, you know, if it's not being kept up for newsworthiness, then what is the calculus that's being applied? Or is it just, we don't take moderation actions against the president? It's a curious thing. It's difficult to wrap one's head around. And it was an interesting kind of little tidbit to find in that decision, but it raises a lot of questions and doesn't really answer them.
It's interesting that you mentioned transparency, because also in the decision, the board points to a number of questions that they asked Facebook, which Facebook refused to answer, which I think makes the board's job extremely difficult. And I'm not sure, do you have thoughts on sort of how that transparency could be improved in further cases that come before the board?
The lack of transparency of Facebook itself is really interesting. A lot of different folks have picked up on that. The fact that the board is asking Facebook these questions and Facebook is declining to respond. First of all, Facebook spent a lot of money on this board and continues to spend a lot of money on this board. So it's kind of puzzling that you put all these resources into it and then you don't really utilize it by giving the information that they want to make the decisions that they want. So that was kind of curious. A lot of folks have pointed to the fact that, you know, it speaks to broader transparency challenges at Facebook itself. If the board, if the Facebook oversight board can't get meaningful information on these issues, like, what hope do the rest of us have in trying to understand the black box that is Facebook and where these decisions are actually coming from? You know, transparency is such a hot issue. People constantly point to that as at the core of solutions to the accountability gap these platforms have, where they're making these incredibly influential decisions without proper oversight, without public accountability. The lack of transparency is always at the core of all of those things. And the fact that not only can the public not even understand this stuff, but even the Facebook Oversight Board can't seem to understand this stuff and can't seem to get them to respond to certain questions, I think is very telling. And it's not a good sign in terms of the need to push for better transparency and accountability at these platforms. As far as what they can do better, you know, I have been an advocate for quite a while that both the platforms and the Facebook Oversight Board should have something akin to a right to information or freedom of information policy, some way to connect requesters with an avenue and a rules-based system to acquire the information that they're requesting. My paper coming out in the fall is going to be exploring that in a bit more detail. But yeah, I think that the lack of transparency, not only between Facebook and the public, but between Facebook and the Oversight Board, is very noteworthy in this decision. And certainly it's something that I imagine we're going to be hearing more about. But it is also good to see that the Facebook Oversight Board, first of all, is needling in this kind of direction. And second of all, that they're not shy about putting in their report that they seem to be poorly served by the lack of responsiveness to these questions. I think that's a good development. It's good to see them sparring back and forth on this. And on the transparency side as well, I will mention, you mentioned that a minority of the board felt a particular way. What is a minority of the board? Who? How many people within that decision-making structure? You know, I think that there's a lot to point to in terms of a lack of transparency at Facebook. I also think that it's fair to criticize the board itself for a lack of transparency. I think the fact that the board members' names are not attached to decisions is hugely problematic. I think the fact that there's a lot of opacity on the way that they themselves operate. I think that that's also problematic, especially if this is going to be such an important governance structure in establishing these incredibly important decisions. I think that there's very strong needs for transparency from the board itself that's not necessarily being met at the moment.
So How has this decision been received? How are people thinking about an oversight board applying international human rights standards to a technology company that is based in the United States? Like, what is that conversation looking like?
Obviously, a lot of people are furious at the decision. You know, certainly for supporters of the former president, they are unhappy with the decision. They think that big tech has gotten too powerful, and their is the typical kinds of responses about how, oh, these tech platforms are once again censoring conservatives, which is a narrative that has persisted for years and years, has precisely zero evidence supporting it. But certainly that's a narrative that has continued through this decision. There are a lot of persistent critics of the Oversight Board that say either that it is a puppet of Facebook, or that it is ill-equipped, or that it is a distraction insofar as it is ill-equipped to actually fix the real problems with Facebook. On the former point, I think that if the board was doing what Facebook wanted it to do, this is not the decision that they would have handed down. I think that it would have been vastly easier for Facebook, first of all, if the board had just decided it one way or the other, rather than handing it back to Facebook to redo their determination of. That's not a pleasant process for a company that is shy about wading into political controversies. And this forces Facebook to keep wallowing in this controversy for longer than they would like to. The other thing that's notable about this decision is it needles a lot of very sensitive areas for Facebook. So I mentioned that the board takes an expansive view of their mandate. You know, the board mentioned challenges around that Facebook should assess the degree to which their algorithmic choices and amplification choices contributed to the assault on the Capitol. That's obviously a very sensitive question for Facebook to deal with. The board doesn't have policymaking power in that space, but the fact that they're calling attention to this problem and needling Facebook on that specific subject is worthwhile. The board noted that there's a need to separate out decision-making about content from government relations. That is a huge issue that civil society people have been that have been concerned about. Critics of Facebook have been concerned that government relations people are given undue influence in content moderation decisions. That's true not only in the US, but certainly there's been a lot of complaints about the Indian government that Facebook there has been overly deferential to Modi and to his governing interests over there and his allies over there. So, you know, these are all very sensitive areas for the company to deal with. And the board has no compunction whatsoever about pointing to these problems and saying, this is a problem that needs to be dealt with. So I think it's certainly not fair to talk about the board as being overly indebted to Facebook or a puppet of Facebook or overly deferential to Facebook. We have not seen that at all. In terms of whether the board is equipped to handle the problems that Facebook faces or whether it's all a distraction and that the problem is the business model, you know, I think that there is potentially something to that. But and certainly, you know, critics of this decision have pointed to it as irrelevant because it's tinkering around the edges of a big of the problems that are at the core of this company. I personally don't see it as an either or. I don't think that there's any reason why you can't read these decisions and engage with them and support the development of case law in this space, which is enormously important and is not going anywhere. The influence of private sector entities in this space is going to be a fact of life going forward. And it's very important to develop standards about how these decisions should be made. And I think the board is contributing in a very valuable way to that and a way that will be valuable going forward. If you still think, as I do, that Facebook is in desperate need of stronger regulation, that there should be a very strong inquiry through antitrust and competition law to look for remedies there. If you think that they are a very ripe target for better, stronger privacy regulations, I believe both of those things. I don't see it as an either or. I think that the Facebook Oversight Board can do good work in developing this space. And I think it's not necessarily going to deflect from the pending antitrust inquiry, which is very sorely needed.
Okay, thank you, Michael. I think we have to leave our conversation there, but I'm sure all of us will be watching very closely to see how Facebook responds to this decision over the next several months. And we're very excited to have you at UCLA, and we look forward to seeing the direction that you will take the new institute.
Thank you so much. Likewise, it's been a lot of fun. I appreciate the invitation, and I'm a huge fan of the Promise Institute, and I look forward to working together.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this content and want to support our work at the intersection of human rights and technology, donate to our programs and initiatives. We do everything from training our students in cutting-edge open-source investigation techniques, to researching the misuse of social media platforms during conflict, to exploring the way the emerging edges of technology, law, and human rights interplay, and how that interplay will shape our futures. This is just some of the innovative work we're doing. Visit law.ucla.edu/support-promise to become a part of the synergy we are building, and thank you. On that note, parting thoughts, be sure you're subscribed to the show. Follow us on social. We're at Promise Inst, I-N-S-T, UCLA. And please, tell a friend about us. Till next time, take care.